Today's program has been brought to you by Calavita. Think outside the bottle with Calavita, America's trusted family brand, makers of extra virgin olive oil and fine Italian food products. Calavita.com.
Today's program has been brought to you by Wines of Bordeaux. Visit their website at bordeaux.com.
Hey, 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 I'm Jimmy Carboni from Beer Sessions Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Food Talk. Mike Colomeco, your host here on another balmy February day in New York City, scenic Bushwick. Yep, the epicenter of hipsterdom. Here we go. So great show today. I've got two fabulously talented guys in. James Kent, who's the chef at Nomad, but has this great story. Like, there's not a whole lot of people. Most New Yorkers that I know are like me. They came here from somewhere else.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of like the New York story.
Yep.
But there are some born and raised types. You happen to be one of them. And then after, we're going to have James the first half hour. He's got to get back to Nomad because he's got a really busy restaurant to run. I've got Nick Morgenstern, who might just chime in during this half hour as well. But I'll have Nick exclusively for the last half hour. And if you haven't heard of Nick Morgenstern, I don't know why you're listening to the show. Because he's huge in the food space. He's been all over New York. I met him when he had the General Green out in Brooklyn. Since then, he's got Gigi's. He's got one of the most dope ice cream shops in the world on the Lower East Side, not far from me. So we talk about the arc of his career, but let's get started with James first. Dude, so tell me. So I'm getting the story. So you grow up, you're a kid living in what neighborhood?
Yes, by Chelsea? So I was born and raised in the city. I basically consider myself a downtown Manhattan kid. I grew up in Greenwich Village. You know, I ran through Soho and Tribeca when it was like abandoned,
empty,
bohemian artists. You know, I had a friend that had a loft that looked like this place out here, and there was a walk-in, a huge walk-in. It was a flower factory, you know, and we go there, and it was just really raw space. And, you know, that was life in Manhattan.
It's good that you remember that. I mean, when Chanterelle opened up at Grand and Green, there was nothing down there. You'd walk those streets at night, and it was like blackouts.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's abandoned.
David would tell of, because he got reviewed really early by Gail Green, really good review. It really put him on the map. And he remembers a lot, you know, people coming down from the Upper East or Upper West Side in taxis. The cab would slow down. They'd, like, look out the window and just say, fuck this.
Yeah.
Get me out of here. It was nothing down there. Like, downtown was empty.
It's really funny. So there was in front of Nobu, they had security. They had a guy, you know, with a gun, and that was like our boy. You know, like, we'd like run the streets and, you know, do dumb stuff.
Kid
like,
shit.
Like kids did. and the Nobu guard was our boy. You know, we'd like go, you know, and he'd like watch out for us, you know?
So playing on the High Line, got a job working at your uncle's restaurant in the theater district at 12, bussing tables to make money. So I started at 13, so you beat me by a year there. And then at some point, this guy named David Boulay turns out to be in your building.
Yes.
Like, you know. And at that point, again, because this is like anytime you talk to me, it's like history lessons. So, I mean, David's off of that. He has that first year with Mon Rocher, which, like, blows. So Mon Rocher, Union Square opened up basically the same year. Those two guys, Danny and Drew, open up the neighborhoods. I mean, Union Square was a shithole. That park was 14th Street was gross.
Yeah, it was
even by my standards, and I had none. Like, you didn't. Like, there was nothing to do on for it. It was dollar stores and shit. And then, you know, Tribeca was nothing. I mean, Odeon had been open, and there was one other bar. But, like, I had friends that had lofts down there too that were artists. I mean, the heat would go off in the
There was nothing there.
Nothing.
There were large buildings that we would that were abandoned that we would like sneak into. It was and now they're like multi-million dollar.
Yeah. It's the most expensive zip code in the city, more than Fifth Avenue. So David opens up Monterche, which is like the really kind of the beginning, and, you know, Danny, same time, same, the beginning of like downtown fine dining. So these are two really talented guys who would go on to become impresarios with just great taste in everything. And, you know, Monterche was unbelievable. Like, I was friends with Drew, knew the opening team. Bill Yosis is on the floor. Bill Yosis was doing pastry. I mean, Daniel Johannes was on the floor pouring wines. It was so much talent in that kitchen. And David Boulay for the first year. Lunch was like $18. Dinner was $22.
Insane.
But David blew up. He just became, he was the first American superstar chef. So they had that horrible falling out. And, you know, didn't talk to each other for years. Drew basically, well, Drew locked him out of the kitchen and had a replacement team hired. But so by the time you meet Boulay, he's got Boulay, which was such a gorgeous dining room.
Yeah. So
and, he, and such a great kitchen.
So he, okay, so it was my freshman year of high school. It was probably 91, 92. You know, and Boulay, they'd probably been open 3 or 4 years. They got 4 stars in the Times. And, like, I was this young kid, and my mom was like, go knock on his door. And I'm like, fuck that. You know, I'm like a little nervous kid, and this is, like, the man. And it was actually really funny. So it turned out that I was, like, afraid to knock on the door, so I wrote these notes and, like, tucked it under his door with my phone number. And I'd, like, forgotten about that. And years later, when, you know, I ran into to him at the James Beard Awards maybe, like, 5, 6 years ago, and I'm like, Boulay, what's up? Yo, we lived in the same building. And he's, you know, he's a mad scientist. He was like, yeah, I don't really know who you are. And I was like, no, no. And, you know, I worked with you for 1 summer. And I came and knocked on your door. And you gave me a job. And he's like, no, 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 you didn't knock on my door. You left these notes. So he knew. You know, he still had a, you know, he still brought it back. But, you know, that summer, I was a young kid. You know, I had no business being in this restaurant at all. But he opened the doors and I walked in, and it was, you know, it was like the first French line in the city. The beautiful stove, beautiful suite. It was actually my
first. Was that
first, a Bonnet? I'm pretty sure.
I think he was one of the early guys that, I mean, that.
Maltini. I think it was Maltini.
Maybe. And the dining room was tweaked out. I remember back then, because I was the executive chef at the Ritz-Carlton in that time span, so I had some money, and I traveled to Europe a lot, and I remember, like, those big wooden oak doors that he had.
Yeah, amazing.
I remember just walking into that dining room, and it felt like you had left New York, and you were somewhere in France.
And the
beam
apples.
Ceilings, the apples, that pile of fruit, amazing. The space between the tables. It was, like, the most gracious dining room in the city, I think, at that time.
It was really, really insane. It was my first,
but the food never
amazing
came out.
Meal. The food never came out.
It was honestly, I love David. I love
That's
him.
So
He's a man.
Funny.
So you're right. But I remember, like, eating there a couple of times, and like ordering our food, and then ordering the wine.
Yeah.
And you'd get an amuse-bouche, and the wine would come, and we were like, finish the wine. It was like an hour before
That's
the first
so
course.
Funny.
It was like, what the fuck? I mean, David's just famous for that.
Yeah.
I never ate there, but all I heard was that he would just refire. I know so many people who work for him, and that rings in my head right now hearing this, that the guy would just, like, throw the dish in the garbage and just do it. And the whole nine top one dish in the garbage, refire the whole thing.
Yeah, that's kind of what I mean. I would go there as, like, deuces and four tops, and it wasn't like we were eating 18-course tasting menus. This was old days of a la carte. This was like 3 courses.
Yeah.
And it would take 4 hours to get through it. It was painful.
So
it was
intense.
But he, you know, super, super talented guy. So that was that freshman year in high school, you spent a summer there.
Freshman year in high school, I spent a summer there. Learned a lot. You know, there were a ton of chefs there. You know, I was really too young. You know, I was the young kid. I was peeling potatoes and carrying things and Frenching, you know, cleaning.
What you
beans.
Should have been doing. Peeling potatoes, peeling carrots.
And I learned a lot. You know, at that point, I knew, I'm like, I want to be a chef. And, you know, I was a young kid. I was 15. I'm like, this is what I want to do. And it's really funny. So that was my first fine dining meal ever. And then, so my mom just moved out of her place on 10th Street. And she's rummaging through things. And she found a Boulay matchbook that I crossed his name out and signed my name over.
Wow.
And then for my birthday, framed it. And so I have this little, like, you know, 6-inch by 6-inch frame with this matchbook inside with Boulay crossed and my name, and it's in my office at the Nomad. And it's just, and just seeing that, you know, 25 years later as a chef and a grown man,
right,
to really realize that, you know, like, I knew exactly what I wanted. You know, it's not like I fell into it. Some people fall into it.
Yeah,
most of us did. Or some people turn into it. Some people are like, all
right. Yeah, right. I mean, a lot of the stories are it was the second, I wanted to be in a band, I wanted to be a writer, I wanted to do something. I made my money cooking.
Of course.
And I kind of got into the whole scene because I like the hours, I didn't mind the drugs and the girls, and I'm like, all right, this isn't fucking bad. I can't play guitar, that well, I'll do this shit.
Free lobster.
Yeah, that's right, that's right.
And then, for me, obviously when I was a young kid, I got pushed into it. My uncle was like, he brought me to Pietrasanta, this restaurant, and was like, you're working tomorrow no matter what. And if you fucking show up late, you're in trouble. And if you call in sick, you have to come see me. And, you know, and I just started at that point. And it was really great that I worked for a family friend because I could never fuck up. And I basically did that all through high school. And it helped me prepare myself for working at a really high level because I never called in sick or missed a day of work for 10 years.
Yeah, well.
Professionally.
I got to ask a question, though. Really, because that level of dedication and that level of commitment, how do you feel now?
Yeah, thank you.
Employing and working with
kids who do not have the same.
I don't even want to go there with it because I'm tired of that conversation. Okay. I really am. All right. The millennial thing and all
whatever.
Of that.
So you know, finish your sentence.
I'm just saying, like, how do you approach and tackle that challenge? Because I can sit on the one side and be like, these kids don't want to show up to work and they want to be a chef at age 20 and blah, blah, blah. And that's not an interesting conversation to me anymore. More so is how do you approach the challenge? Because what I'm finding is that that generation has so much to contribute, so much more understanding of different types of communication, so much understanding of like nuance and creativity. And like for us in our business, everyone who works for me, I got 50 people working for me, nobody's 30 years old. They're not even 30.
Yeah, yeah.
And what I see where we could be frustrated on that level, like that's an old school discipline, what you're talking about. Yeah. I grew up cooking in those places where like, you didn't show up late? What are you, nuts?
Yeah.
You were showing up hours early.
No sick, no late.
No.
No
phones.
Never out sick. No nothing. You were the first guy in, the last guy out.
Yo, me too. 10 years, I never called in sick, not once.
Yeah.
Never.
All of us.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
That's not an option.
Because who would have filled in for you? That was the problem.
That's what it is. I think like for us at the Nomad, we have such a large team and we have a large sous-chef team that we can absorb some things. Like if someone like is sick, okay, one of my sous-chefs is on the line sorting it out. You know, but I worked in these small kitchens. You know, I was at Babo, it was my first kitchen out of school, and there were 5 cooks. If I called in sick, my team would fucking suffer.
Correct.
So it's like,
yeah, don't fuck the team.
No, that's what it was.
For sure.
It was
absolutely
more about the team for me.
Yeah, there was this fixed amount of players. I mean, so I grew up in the old brigade system.
Yeah.
So Saucier, Entremetier, Poissonnier, Griade, whatever. And you came in, you did your mise en place, and you worked that position online. If you weren't there, someone else has to do all of your mise en place. Someone else has to pick up your spot online. Oftentimes it meant the chef had to come back, which he didn't want to do, because they were normally expediters at that point. You know, it's like a basketball team minus one guy. That's not a team anymore.
And if you were going to have a day off, you were queuing up all your plus for 2 days of service before you got on the line, right? I mean, that's what my question to you is, like, how do you feel? Because that has to be something that's very visceral for you, working with managing a younger generation of cooks now.
Yeah, you know, I think it's very tough. I think, like, for me, I try to instill greatness in these guys, you know, and I really hate using, you know, my younger years. Like, I never called in sick for 10 fucking years, and you're 21, and I'm like, seriously, like, if you want to succeed, you're never going to be running kitchens at this level ever if this is how you work. You know, and it's really like...
That perception now is that that's not even... Like, I think that there is a perception that success will exist in a much different way than the way that we perceive that. That, yes, if you don't put it down so hard, then you're not going to succeed. That's not the perception. The perception is not that success is going to be tied to whether or not you show up to work or not, late or on time or sick or whatever.
But so now we had a conversation going. So sorry. So Nick, to you. So what is there? So what is success then to them? How do they think they're going to get? I mean, so there is this arc of a career, and you sort of go from A to B to C. You follow.
But definitely the quality that I would say is consistent, and this is just my observation, and I think it took me a lot of years to get past that frustration. It was like really frustrating and can really feel insulting. You know, you take it personally, and then just continuing on and working with people. And I'm in business, so like I got to work with what's out there. That I think that the consistent theme, though, is how dynamic that generation is. And I say that with respect. Mm. Like, they are dynamic in that they have many different interests in many different things. So if you have six in your mind and your reality, you have six different pots boiling at the same time, then you can move. And there's that, that's where that perception is that you're going to, so success means that you're cooking a lot of things at the same time in your reality, whether you're, so, and what I think the hard part is that there's a lack of focus. Because what you're talking about, you got to go 10 years hard, 6 days a week, 90 hours to get to that level. That requires an incredible level of focus. And so the landscape of what the next generation of chefs is going to look like is probably going to look different than us three old men think it's going to look like.
Or one old man and two young guys.
I think also, like, there's, you know, these young guys have all these different options. You know, that, like, before, even, you know, like, the only option was, like, going to Paris and learning French food and coming back to New York. Even for me, it was it was different. Like, I could learn how to cook here. You know, so as we grow and we evolve, you know, now there are more options. There are these social media, you know, chefs, and there's, you know, all the TV shows and all this other nonsense. You know, there's always the option to really dig down deep and work at, you know, these amazing restaurants. And, you know, there's that path, but now there's these other paths for success, which, you know, like, you know, you ask, you know, what does that really mean?
So where did, so you had a bunch of experience and you decided to go to cooking school?
Yeah.
You did? Where'd you go?
Well, I went to Johnson & Wales in Rhode Island. It was more because my uncle was like, hey, just start cooking. And it was more like I wanted to just not dive in 100% when I was 18.
Did you find going to school with experience helped you in school?
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, big time. I went to the CIA and I already had like 8 years under my belt. And it was so different than the kids next to me who had really never worked in the business.
Yeah.
Like I knew what I wanted to ask. I knew the big questions I had. And I look back, I laugh now. But I mean, I really had like, I was going to dig the shit out of that experience. 100%. And I did. I got a ton out of the CIA.
But that's the thing is if you show up, you're going to get out of it what you put into it. And if you're already primed, then you're going to get more out of it. You know?
And, you know, and like, you know, I definitely always took everything to task. And I was the one that wanted to do everything, get my hands dirty. But, you know, like, I also, because culinary school, you work 6 hours. You know, and then you're like, okay, let me, you know, do, you know, let me hang out. I went to Europe every summer. I would fly to Amsterdam on a whim. You know, I would do all these things as a young man, which helped me become the person and the chef that I am, which I couldn't have done if I was, you know, cooking in the kitchen 20 hours. You know, 12 hours a day as a young man. So like those 4 years, you know, it was more of me taking a break before diving in head first. And
where else did you work in New York before 11 Mad?
So I worked at Babbo for two
Mario.
Years. And I started there in 01. I worked at Jean Georges and that like really helped me refine because Babbo was a really loose kitchen and it was busy. Like I learned how to cook there.
Right.
You know, I learned how to like
put it out.
Man, I got my ass kicked. So I basically went from Garmache to the grill. And I got my ass chewed out. You know, and the grill, there were 15 proteins, which is not normal. You have 15 proteins to, like, cook for, like, 350 people a night. But I was there for 2 years and learned a lot. And then I went to Jean Georges, and I was a mess. You know, I was dirty, and there I got my ass kicked.
Yeah, he's Alsatian. He's basically German, and that he's always been. I remember when he arrived in New York, the hair, the look, super clean. And I'd worked with Swiss and German guys, and he had a real sense of refinement too. He was a guy that really brought. When he opened up in the Lafayette in the Drake Swiss Hotel. We all ate there, and it was a food that no one had seen in New York before.
Cool. Man, when Mike is on the mic, he just, like, bring it back so far. Lafayette and Drake.
The guy was like, no one hits it. We were all making, you know, demi-glace and beurre blanc and the basic shit, hollandaise, the variations of the mother sauces. And this guy's like, what the fuck? These, like, juice purees and purees of carrots. And what is this shit? And he'd worked in Asia, so he had that sensibility. So he and that sort of Swiss, German, Austrian precision, even though he's Alsatian, but it was
a beautiful kitchen.
Yeah.
And it literally, you had to be clean, man. If you had one drop on you, you failed. If there was salt on your station, you failed.
Right.
And they were like really, really strict about it. Mm-hmm. You know, labels cut perfectly, walk in perfect, you know, and like I learned a lot. And I went from Babbo, which was busy, amazing, learned a lot, delicious food, but
looser.
It was really more about just cooking food here at JG. It was like refinement and learning a lot of technique, you know, that really helped me. And I learned a lot. And met a lot of great cooks that are now chefs in working places that are really good, dear friends of mine. And I was there for 2 years, and they offered me a sous chef job. And I was like, you know, like, I'd only been cooking, you know, for 4 years. I was like, I need to learn more, you know. And then Gordon Ramsay opened in the city, and I went to Trail at Per Se and Gordon Ramsay. And they basically offered me a job in both places. And, you know, Gordon was just like asshole chef and came in with his persona, which, you know, I didn't necessarily love, but the kitchen was brand new. It was opening a restaurant. It was like building something. So I opened that restaurant and I was there for 6 months and realized it really wasn't for me. So I was like, wow, I miss working at Per Se, best restaurant in New York at the time. And then, but really like things happened. And I was there for 6 months, and it allowed me to find 11 Madison Park, and you know, like this young chef came to New York, and you
speaking
know,
of Swiss,
yeah, crazy people,
yeah,
you know, and I walked into this kitchen, and it's funny. So on the day that I trailed at 11 Madison Park, I walked into the dining room, and I heard my grandfather's song was playing in the dining room. And my grandfather's Charles Mingus. He's a jazz bassist from
you
back
told
in the day.
Me this. I, when yeah, I filmed this. That's I'm such a space cadet. Because he had the picture of Miles for years. I don't know if it's still there in the kitchen of E&P. Huge picture of Miles. And Bill Evans is a friend of mine. He's a horn player. That's right. Mingus, man. One of the maybe the greatest jazz bass player ever. A tyrant to work for.
Yeah,
just a giant of a man in every sense of the word.
And then, so I walked in. And
what
I was
playing? Pork Pie Hat? What was it?
It was Pork Pie Hat.
Fuck. What a tune.
And it's crazy. Like, I walk in this place. You know, I'm a...
I love that tune.
I'm like a seasoned cook, super nervous. It's a new kitchen, whatever. And I walk in and I hear this tune. I'm like, wow, this is it.
That's karma.
Crazy. And this is 10 years later. I've been with Daniel for 9 years now.
Wow.
Yeah, that was a great turnaround. I have to say, Daniel came in from Compton Place, from California. You know, Danny's the curator of talent.
Yep.
He's able to pick people and find people. And so Switzerland, Compton Place is always a great kitchen. I knew, like, the previous Laurent, it was three or four chefs I'd eaten there over the years. It was just a great San Francisco boutique hotel. And he comes to New York, it's his first gig, and he's replacing Curry, and that was my least favorite of Danny's restaurants. I don't know why. I never loved the dining room. It always seemed kind of cold. And then Curry's, just, they had Curry doing like bistro kind of food.
It was a bistro
in this bank vault setting.
Yeah, it just didn't make sense.
It just didn't. There was something about it that didn't work. And in comes this guy, and I don't think, I mean, to you, turning around a restaurant is so hard. I mean, it's like getting an ocean liner to do pirouettes. It's 100%. So hard. So this guy comes in and he's so patient. And
I don't know about patient. Patient. I don't know if that's.
But I mean, he's got to wean out the cooks. Yeah, get rid of. He's got to turn everything around. Do his. And within a couple of years, it went from being Danny's worst restaurant to being the jewel.
Yeah.
Through his efforts.
You know, it's you know, I walked in and Chef Daniel he'd been there for maybe a little less than a year. Mm-hmm. They just got 3 stars in the Times. And I was looking for like a place to grow, you know, to really help to join the management team. And, you know, I was trying to find a home and I walk in and Daniel was like, we're going to get 4 stars. I promise you off the bat. And then, so I started as a meat roast, and it's funny cause they were looking for a sous chef. And, you know, whenever a sous chef comes in to gets hired in from outside, it never works.
I would agree.
Very hard.
Right.
Very difficult. Works.
Right.
Yeah.
You got to come up.
Yeah. So, you know, I chose to come and cook, and I cooked for like 3 weeks as the roast. And then chef was like, you know, it's you, you know, and at that point, and it was a pirate ship at that point. It was such a, you know, chef had these standards that not many people in the restaurant really understood, you know, and so... We'd be going into service, and he'd fire the whole line. And I'm like, Chef, you do that after service. What are you doing? You know, like, but he had these standards. He had these, you know, he had these serious standards, and he cared so deeply, and it was really important to him.
I was at Gramercy when he took over.
Yeah.
And he was just, like, crushing pastry chefs.
Yeah.
Just was, like, knocking them off the table. I remember that. It was, like... It happened. He kind of, peripherally, he expressed interest in if I would want to be over there. And I was like, I don't know if I'm trying to get on a pirate ship right now.
Honestly, like, the first year was very tough. And there were times where I questioned my, you know, me being there. But, you know, we had just these larger goals. And it was literally after that first year, we started building. You know, Bryce started with us.
Yeah.
Abram Bissell, who's now at the Modern Starter with us. This guy, Fabien Beaufort, who just got his first Michelin star in France. So we started growing, and there were people that started really buying in. And, you know, those are the guys that helped change this restaurant. Angela Pinkerton, the pastry chef, that, you know, she was a pastry cook. And see, chef, he wanted it to be his vision. And every pastry chef, they wanted to own their own. It's like, yo, this is my vision. And, you know, chef is the old school European. He's like, you know, it's one vision for the restaurant, you know. Yeah. So, and the pastry chefs, it was very challenging for them. So chef, it didn't really work. But Angela was amazing, and she was just part of the team, and she grew, and we all created food together.
Where's she now? Is she at Bentley?
She moved to San Francisco.
Okay.
She works at Craftsman and Wolves.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, she, you know, worked in this behemoth of a restaurant and said it's time to, like, you know, the pastry chefs eventually kind of move on and open up pastry shops and, you know, chocolate shops and whatnot. You know, I think that's on her path. Yeah.
So tell me about the, you know, I this is embarrassing. I have not been to the Nomad for dinner yet. And you've been open 4 years,
four years.
So talk about that. Because I remember when we were filming.
Yeah.
I remember, like, off to the side, Will and Daniel, they had already had the gig. And I could just hear them in the chef's office, like, answering phone calls about, like, what's the menu going to be? What do you think the menu's going to be? What's the check average going to be? I don't know what the content is going to be. It was really like, whoa, these guys are winging this shit.
Yeah.
I mean, they'd already purchased the restaurant from Danny, so now it's their baby. And now they've got this other, I bet people throwing money at them because they got the 4 stars and they know that they're young and they're hot. So tell me about what's the Nomad about?
Well, so the Nomad is basically, it's an opportunity for us to just reach more people. You know, so 11 Madison Park is about evolution. You know, our muse is Miles Davis, and he's just all about being creative and forward-thinking, and EMP is that. You know, we evolve and grow, and, you know, and the menu changes, and we oftentimes don't use some of the great ingredients or techniques that we've had in the past. So it's an opportunity for us to use it at the Nomad. So a lot of the food that we serve at the Nomad, you know, feels like is from the 11 Madison Park spirit, and flavors and techniques, and it's really just an opportunity for us to reach more people, man. And so EMP is very proper. It's this beautiful dining room. You sit down, you sit up straight, you wear, like, you look amazing. And the Nomad is really, it's a party, man. You come up on a Tuesday night, and it's just rocking, man. There's all these beautiful different rooms, and we'll have, you know, young cooks coming in to eat just to taste the food. Then we'll have, like, artists in the corner and models. It's just, like, this cross-section of New York City, which is so cool. And then, you know, we have the library, which is a chill spot. We have the bar, which you can just drink and eat a hot dog. You know, it's there's so many different options, and we can just reach so many different people. You know,
so it's, you know, you sort of, that you graduated from the EMP thing, but that's it. That's the suja. It's 4 stars. It is what it is. It's Michelin 3 stars, Relais and Chateau. That tasting menu. You sign up for the whole. And this is a chance to sort of loosen up the collar and have fun and do great food.
Hey, and like at the Nomad, you can come 3 times a week. We people that live there, they, you know, literally they come to the library every day, you know, at EMP, for you to go there 3 times a week, you know, it's a time commitment.
It costs a fortune.
And, you know, the Nomad, you can go and have an amazing cocktail, and that's it. And then leave and come back, you know, and it's really...
I got to come in one of these Tuesdays. I'm going to take up on that offer. Well, that wasn't an offer. I just have to come in.
Tuesday
nights, I'm there. And congratulations. I should point this out because there's some, you know, I have you guys, we know each other these days. I'm reluctantly being dragged into the 21st century. So social media is a part of that. So people are like, Mike, you got to do the Facebook. You got to do Instagram. You got to do this shit. You got to interact with the community and your audience. And I'm like, okay, whatever. It's not, no, I'm much more a private person, so it's not my style. But it's congratulations on the marathon. Yeah, I know there's a whole bunch of you, Bobby Damasco, you. Yep. I know Matt at the Musket Rooms training for something.
He's looking good.
He's doing martial arts. He's posting pictures of himself at the gym. I'm doing it today.
He's looking good.
Yeah, it's great to see that. It's great to see chefs paying attention to their health. And shockingly, so we're... Who was I talking to? Was it maybe at your book party?
Yeah.
Somebody just mentioned, it was you. You mentioned it. We're talking about your training, and because it was after the marathon or right before, I don't remember the time frame. And you said, you know, Daniel runs marathons, Daniel Hum. And I'm like, how the fuck does this guy have time to do anything? To do? Yeah. Not only does he run marathons, the son of a bitch ran New York and finished in like 218 or 220.
He was the 200th person to cross the line.
That's world class. Wow. I mean, that's ridiculous. Yeah. That's a time that's falling within the parameters of the elite people.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just nuts.
He's super intense. He's super competitive, you know, and he just has it in him. And that's what pushed the restaurant and us, you know. It's like, it just shows exactly like who he is. If he can do that, if he can push EMP to 3 stars and top 5 in the world, like, you know, like,
yeah.
It's his life. It's not just like...
It's funny. You mentioned the thing about the 4 stars times. When Thomas Keller opened Per Se, we filmed, and I was in there, in the kitchen a few times before. I wanted to wait for them to get reviewed, let the Bruni thing get out of the way. I don't want to have cameras rolling in front. So just like get that over with. So while I was hanging out in the kitchen to sort of do research for the show we'd eventually do, his screensaver was 4 stars.
Yeah.
On all the computers, it was 4. The guy, Thomas Keller, just, there was one thing he wanted.
Yeah.
And that was it. It was just that obsession, we're going to do this. And kind of sad. I mean, to read those last couple of reviews, that review a couple of weeks ago was tough.
Yeah, I think it's definitely challenging. You know, Thomas, I've been lucky enough to really work with him over the past 5 years with the Book Restore and all these other things. And man, just the excellence that this guy is just... You know, I don't know. It's tough. It was challenging to read it, and
for me, and I'm not in his universe. I mean, you guys came out of his, but I just, you know, Benno and Corey and all the guys that have come up through that. It's been like a graduate school for a generation 100%. Of young American chess. And he's the guy. I mean, I think he's like the paramount. What Boulay had for a bit, 100%. Thomas Keller's carried that mantle 100%. Forward. I remember eating at French Laundry in 2000, 2001, and somebody said, "What'd you think?" I said, "It's a free." And by then, I'd eaten at every Michelin 3-star restaurant that there was. You name them, I ate at all of them. Awesome. And I remember saying, "This is the first time I've ever had Michelin 3 stars in America." The French Laundry in 2000. Mm-hmm. That was the standard. He hit it, and I was like, "Fuck!" And I remember hanging out in that kitchen, just watching the attention to detail. So that was like a fucked up thing to read, and it was so personal and just visceral. But anyway, congratulations on your shit. New York born and bred. You're into graffiti. You skateboard at all?
When I was a kid, I used to skateboard with like, you know, the New York City greats, Harold Hunter, who's one of like the New York City
OG.
Legends.
Yep.
He was one of my boys as a kid, and you know, we just grew up in the downtown Greenwich Village, you know, Washington Square Park. You know, that was like my like stomping ground.
Well, that's great. New York native, done great. Congratulations on everything. I'm going to see you Tuesday night in the next couple of weeks at Nomad. James, you got a great new book out, and that book's sick, dude. I mean, hello.
Yeah, with the cocktail book?
Cocktail book built into it. I mean, like, what? They had those little bags that night. I'm like, holy shit. I still have that bag. Just walk around and impress people. I'm just going to walk around like Lower Side with that. I got the bag, man.
Yeah, black and gold, man. Looks good.
I got the bag. All right, take care. We're going to take a quick break. Come back with Nick Morgenstern. Stay tuned for that.
Awesome. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Folks, Mike Helimeco here. Everybody knows that great cooking really starts with great ingredients, and these days we have so many options to choose from. Well, I go back to the Colavita family brand for years, and there really is a Colavita family behind this brand. I got their story long after I started using their products. Back in the mid-80s, when I was the chef at the Ritz-Carlton here in New York City, one of the things you can do as a chef is order your own food. You do the purchasing, and we switched olive oils to Colavita. When I had my own restaurant down in Cape May, New Jersey, the Globe, for years, that's all we ever poured at the table. That's all I ever cooked with. And then when I started my PBS show in 1999, I thought, you know, if I'm going to look after underwriting and funders, why don't I go after products that I actually use at home, that I actually cook for my family with and in my restaurant with. I've been working with them for 15 years with the PBS series and now with Heritage Radio. The Colavita family goes back generations in Italy. They make their olive oil from great sourced olives, traceable source olives, just south of Rome in Molise province, Abruzzo, which is where my family hails from. Since then, their family's moved here, so there's Colavita is living in Rome. Colavita is living in America. It's a great, trusted family brand. It's the olive oil I use, and I'd recommend you try it as well. So if you listen to the show, you know I am a wine lover. We get sommeliers here all the time. We get winemakers. I've been drinking wine with dinner since before most of you were born. And when you think of the great wine regions of the world, I mean, what comes to mind? Bordeaux, Burgundy, Champagne, Piedmont? Yeah, okay. Well, I just got back from Bordeaux. Was there for the crush for the 2015 harvest. And I was thrilled to see, A, how the city of Bordeaux has transformed itself. It's so alive. It's so beautiful. And the region itself is crazy. There's a whole new generation of young vignerons were coming in, and they're not making your grandfather's Bordeaux anymore. Young farmers, young vignerons that have been there for generations, that know the soil, that know the grapes. And what grapes are we talking about? You know, we're pretty familiar here. Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Cab Franc, Petit Verdot, Malbec, all of those grapes find themselves in these blends. But the new style of Bordeaux wines are super fresh, super young, super clean, meant to be consumed now, not cellared for decades, because really, who has a cellar? The whites are super great. I think they're super undervalued and appreciated. Semillon, Sauvignon Blanc, crisp, dry, all stainless. If there's a little oak integration, you barely feel it. And the reds come in all sorts of styles. You know, the left bank is a little more Cabernet Sauvignon heavy, a little more structured, a little more tannic. The right bank with more Merlot tends to be fruity, a little more opened up, receives you a little bit easier. But if you've been walking past that Bordeaux aisle in your wine store, stop and grab a bottle. From $15 to $35 is some of the best value on planet Earth. With wines that are growing in one of the great wine regions, vignerons that are passionate, they know what they're doing. Give Bordeaux a second shot. I love the wines. Hey, we're back. Liz, did you have ice cream? I just need a yes or no answer. Liz, are you eating ice cream? Okay, I got a thumbs up. Good. Because awesome. Nick Morganstone brought some of his ridiculous ice cream.
I never bring ice cream anywhere. People are always like, where's the ice cream? And I'm like, you're joking, right? I can't roll around with ice cream. And I'm not running straight from the freezer to see you. I might have other things going on in between.
You and you brought ice cream. So
and I was like, yo, I talked to my guy, and I was like, I need to bring some ice cream for Mike, for sure.
Fucking honored. Honored.
Yeah, man.
And I hope the Jack and Liz are enjoying that. Good looking. Insane flavors. Save me some. Save me some. Don't finish that. Don't finish all that, guys. You're going to owe me a... All right, so Nick Morganstern. So your background, we just heard James Kent, which is crazy. A lot of stuff I didn't know.
Awesome guy.
Although I did interview him when I was filming. I just don't have a great memory. Just a lot of faces, and I'm special at nice to box.
Other things.
I get hit in the head a lot. So you came to New York from...
I mean, I moved here from Hawaii, actually. I was living in Hawaii. I was living on Maui.
What?
Yep.
Possessed
good question.
You to kind of leave.
I was working in San Francisco.
Paradise.
Yeah. Well,
you surf?
I do. I went down there to cook. I was living and working in San Francisco, where I'm from.
Okay.
I had left San Francisco. I lived in Germany. Cooked in Germany. Came back to San Francisco, and I worked at a couple places, and then I got locked in with Michael Mina.
Oh,
and
gotcha.
This was back when Ron Siegel was running those. So it was a different time, and I worked at Aqua, which was this big monster.
Yep.
And to this day was probably one of the most formidable experiences, where it was like super high standard for how things get done, and you have to do it with nothing. You have no space. You have no time. It's and in other places, I went to work at other big places where the standard was high, if not higher, but like you just had more. You had more equipment, more space, more air conditioning, blah, 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 blah. So Mina was opening a restaurant in Hawaii, in the Grand Wailea Hotel on the south side of Maui. And
I know the hotel.
And I wasn't like dying to go down there.
That part?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
You're BlackRock.
I was going to go down there, exactly. And I went down there to work with a guy named Chris Lahamidou, who later went on to work, was like right hand to Benno at Per Se, and then went back to San Francisco and got Mina 4 stars recently at Michael Mina. An unbelievable person. He passed like a year ago. He had a really, really serious medical condition. Very sad. But such one of these guys that was so magnanimous and just like incredible positive energy combined with technique, skill, communication, just was incredible. And basically I followed him down there with my buddy Mikey LaFaro, who's from out here from Block Island, who's still there. Mikey's still there. I left, though. Like, I had to get out, and I was living in the woods in a little shack, driving an 81 Toyota 4x4 camouflage, going to work every day, swim in the ocean every day, and
those
look in
turtles.
The rearview mirror on your way home and see another postcard sunset. And one day I was like, enough of this shit. I was like, enough of this shit. I'm out of here. You know? And so I moved from Hawaii straight to New York and came to work here for Pat Costin at a restaurant called Elo. Rick Lackinen was the chef there.
Yeah, that was an amazing restaurant.
It was killer.
Elo was in the Bryant Hotel.
That's right.
And Rick, I have to tell you, Rick is a badass dude.
Yeah.
I don't know what.
He was a beast.
Know where Rick is these days? Is he in Westchester?
I don't know.
He was such a talented mofo.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He had come from the River Cafe.
Who was that crazy chocolate guy he had that was out of his mind?
That was Pat.
That guy.
Yeah. Pat and I own that chocolate company together.
I remember that guy. He was like Pat's Alex Tupac. Batshit crazy,
More, yeah, super intense. I talk to Pat all the time. He's a beast.
And Pat's we don't know what happened to Lekkonen. He just went into the vapors of super talented chefs who never got their props, who just didn't get the right review. And that guy was as good as anybody.
There's a lot of guys, I think, actually, that this business is scary, bro.
Dude, I know.
I tell people all the time, you better have a stomach for this, man. I'm serious.
There is no fairness. There is no justice. It's not like hard work is not necessarily going to pay off.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, there's a lot of pieces that can go wrong.
Yeah.
You were in that kitchen. I mean, that was a great freaking restaurant. Yeah, opened for like a year.
It was really good. I worked with a guy named Sal Spufaro. Sal is the man. Oh, it was great.
And so that's when you segued into pastry. And then when you were, who else's kitchen after that?
I went to work with Johnny at Danielle.
Okay, that's what I thought.
And Johnny left, and I stayed at Danielle, and then I went to France, and I worked in a lot of places.
Hot side, cold side?
Always at pastry.
Always pastry?
Always in pastry.
Okay.
And I worked with a lot of different people.
Did you cooking school for pastry?
Yep, in San Francisco.
Okay.
A long time ago. And so, yeah, I did that stuff. I think that I just sort of saw that being a pastry chef wasn't going to be... It wasn't going to – that lane has just gotten narrower and narrower, and there's just not a lot of room to do things with that. So, and I see it now. I mean, I really do. I see being a pastry chef is harder and harder. There's less and less room in the budget for that, you know. Every time we increase the minimum wage for tipped employees.
So why don't – so you're smart, super smart. You're in the game. Give me your take. I was on the phone –
on
twice
that?
Today, on that. Because, I mean, so the deal is in New York. Everyone knows this. So now, as of this year, we're beginning to segue up to this new floor. So the concern everybody has is the wait staff's now making $7.50 an hour.
Yeah.
They're making a shit ton of money.
Yeah.
There's still the people that need
I'm going to break it down.
Huh?
Well, I'm going to break it down. Because it's not that interesting to me.
It's
a challenge.
Okay.
Just like working with the new generation is a challenge. Well, I would rather work with the new generation and talk about that than about what's going on with the tips. In this business, people do not get paid for the work that they do. You worked for a very long time. I worked for so long. I can't even think of how many hours I worked that I didn't get paid for. And it's frustrating as an employer to say that the people who already make a lot of money are going to be mandated to make even more money. But you know what's going to happen is that's going to level the playing field for compensation. It's going to take time, and it's going to hurt for a while. It's going to be hard. It's going to hurt. But my long view, and I want to be positive about it, because I'm in this business. I'm not going anywhere else. This is what I'm going to do. So figure it out. Is that eventually what's going to happen is it's going to kick back probably to where tips are no longer going to be a line item that you fill in on the check. Prices are all going to go up. Right. And then the compensation goes back to distribution by the employer. And what that's going to do is it's going to create a much more equitable, fair wage for the guys that work in the kitchen.
I hope you're right.
And you know what's going to happen then? Then you're going to – entry wage for a cook is going to be $15 an hour, which is what it should be.
Yeah.
And then we're going to be able to have people who take this seriously as a career and not just have it full of freaking lunatics, bro. When I was growing up cooking in the kitchen, I was like, you have to be out of your mind to make $9 an hour and do this job.
Yeah, you had to be.
So there were a lot of crazy people, and I'm not.
You
were crazy. You had to be nuts.
And there wasn't, and there was, I'm a little before you, and there weren't a lot of options in terms of restaurants for us. So it was just shut the fuck up. This is the rules, man.
That's it, man.
So you're going to get paid for 35 hours. You're going to work 80, and that's the deal.
That's it.
And if you don't like it, I got a stack of resumes.
Yep.
You're gone.
Yep.
And that's
changed.
I hope you're right
about this. That's changed. But that's what I think.
But also, you know, I never want to sound like the old guy that looks back with those rosy. The food that's the scene today, I can't necessarily speak to the line cooks because I'm not on the line, but the ingredients you guys have to play with.
Yep.
This is across the board. The food today is so much better than it was 15, 20, 25 years ago.
Yeah.
And no insult to Andre Salton or Alan Sayak or any of those guys. They did the best with what they had.
Absolutely.
It was like the Cisco truck pulled up.
Yeah, man.
I mean, it was the same menu basically 12 months out of the year.
Yep.
You go to any of those restaurants, it was interchangeable, the same 12 basic items.
Yep.
The food today is fucking a million times better than ever.
But it's, you gotta, it's the time. You can't take for granted the fact that we have an audience, like the consumers, the generation that's way behind us that is interested in food, educated about food, their own palate is educated.
It's crazy.
But that creates a tremendous market to be able to do things. You know, I have this place called El Rey. And
Let's talk about you first. So when I met you was General Green. You're out of that now. So now you're back into Manhattan. You opened Goat Town. That's now Gigi's. It's totally cool. I love it. It's approachable as can be. It's a really simple formula. You got that big deck oven that's doing simple roast and really great, great pizza.
Yep.
Easy price point. You have Morgan Stern's ice cream that just is insane. It's just art. It's the art of fucking ice cream, dude. That place is ridiculous. Thanks, and then you opened up what I kind of thought was like, wasn't sure where you were going. Is it Rivington?
Stanton.
Okay. I was always
the parlor's on Rivington.
I always get those two confused. Yeah. Anyway, it's on the north side of the block, mid block between like Ludlow and Orchard or one of those blocks. And it's tiny. And I thought it opened as like a little coffee shop or whatever it was, smoothies and snack. Yeah, and then little by little, I'm reading it. It's like morphing into, oh, we're doing lunch now. And then we're doing dinner now. And then like friends of mine who are like in social media who I trust are like, This place is great. Like, it's serious. So talk about El Rey, because that's like a concept. What did you
First of all, it's not serious. Because it really is. El Rey is just an evolution of different ideas. But Gerardo Gonzalez, who did his externship with me at the General Green, and he and I have this working relationship that I can't even describe. Mm-hmm. But the evolution of what has happened at El Rey with the food is born of two things. It's his ideas about food, which are not hindered by a traditional structure of coming up in kitchens where people hit you over the head and tell you to do things a certain way. He has a lot of cultural references from the way that he connects his reality to food in a way that's so personal. So he has a lot of different influences. And then he really approached that project like he was going to do whatever the F it took to make it happen. And he just kept ratcheting it up for himself. I mean, I support him. I run that store. I'm the principal on that store. I make sure that it is open for business and we work on that together. It's a challenge managing the budgets and all that stuff. It's a tiny little store.
600 square feet?
350.
350.
Come on.
It's the size of a New York studio. That's right. I mean, yeah, seriously, man. Kitchen must be what? A couple of induction burners?
Yeah, there's no kitchen. This is like, so that's what I'm saying. Listen, we started talking today about like where that dynamic element of what this generation behind us, guys that I grew up cooking with who are mad talented, who have the technique and the skill set and all that stuff, would never have been able to create what he created there. Because
he's unencumbered by
and he's like so dynamic, you know? And so that's what I'm telling you, is that that's where the inspiration comes from. And I stopped worrying so much about the frustration over a generation that it has a different type of focus.
Right, we're using a metric that's an antique metric.
That's what I'm saying. And listen, as the world moves faster and faster and faster, it's going to change and evolve quicker. But and by the same stroke, we have this opportunity to experience such a broad spectrum of things, of food, of art, of music, of everything. Like, there's so many different places to look at stuff. I told you I'm a Dotson fanatic. I'm a Dotson fanatic. And I was on Jay Leno's Video Garage. And I'm not a big Jay Leno fan, but
he's got some cars.
But dude.
Dude's got some cars. I mean, Ralph Lauren may have a few more, but Jay's got some shit.
Jay's a beast with what he's interested in, though. He's interested in weird stuff, and he respects Dotson. No, people don't really know.
That's not a brand name anymore. Where'd they become?
Dotson, it's a long story, but basically,
whatever.
Dotson became Nissan. Dotson became Nissan. He had a guy on the show the other day that took this crazy, weird, weird truck that is called a Sunny and made a hybrid out of it with something called a Skyline. Neither of these things are imported to the United States. And I was looking at this thing and I was like, man, I'm not into this BS tuner stuff. I like the classic stuff because I'm an old man. But I saw that truck. Man. Yo, and Jay was driving that thing.
I bet.
And he's old and he was like, fuck! Like, he was getting his neck snapped back. And I was like, look at what that guy just did. And the build on this truck is like bananas, 4-star, like sick. And I'm like, that guy's younger than me. He saw that. He had that vision, and he finished it with the finish on it is like, it looks like a factory car. You know, he was on the floor at SEMA. You don't get on the SEMA floor if you don't know what you're doing. So that's what I'm saying. Like, that guy has space in the lane because the world is moving faster, is more dynamic that way. And that's what's happening in food, too.
And I never, ever want to sound like that guy that talks about the old days were better. The food scene, like, when I got to New York 1982, there was, like, you know, a dozen restaurants. It was ridiculous. They're all on the Upper East Side. It was the Laylock group. That was it. You look at how fluid it's become, and... So I'm in Bordeaux this past September filming a show on Bordeaux wines. And Patrick Capiello's in the same hotel with a group of Psalms. All the Psalms he's with are between the ages of like 22 and 31.
Wow.
And the bulk load of them were like in the mid-20s. And I was hanging out with them because I'm really into wine and food. Yeah. And I'm just plotzed. I'm like looking at these guys and girls asking honestly, how the fuck at your age – Do you know this much about wine?
Yeah.
And it's a generation, I don't know what the name is, the millennials, the post-millennials, or whatever. They are so stoked about food that they are the fuel behind this whole thing.
That's what I'm saying. And they also access like such ease of access. If you want to go down a rabbit hole to get the knowledge on something, it's so much easier now. You just get on the search engine and just start looking for any. You can go down the rabbit hole so much easier than you used to have to go and try to find that book somewhere.
And in the world of wine, the wines are here now. Because back to my time, it was Bordeaux, Burgundy, and Champagne.
So much more access.
Loire, all these other places have just bubbled up. It's like the best time to be in New York for food is today. And the next best time is going to be tomorrow.
Tomorrow, exactly.
It's crazy.
I agree.
I mean, you look at your neighborhood where you're on the Lower East Side, and I think of guys like Fung Tu, Contra, Wild Air. The guys just ended up Low Life. Yeah, I'm looking at these
restaurants.
They're all
doing it, man.
They're killing it.
For sure. Totally. Yeah.
So talk about Morgan Stearns, because I love what about you. There's this sort of voracious curiosity, and you're never, I always get the sense that whatever projects you're doing, you're two projects ahead of that. That's kind of how you are. So Morgan Stearns was something you had in your head for a while.
Long time, yeah. I was thinking about it for a long time.
To do this really artisanal ice cream. Talk about the style of the ice cream, because, I mean, when I was a pastry guy, ice cream was made based. The creme glaze was our base.
Right.
And we would turn it through the thing before service every night.
Yep.
So it was egg-based. It could be heavy cream. It could be milk. It could be half and half. There's sugar in there and there's flavorings. Yep. That's what it was.
Our bases for all of our products are just milk, cream, sugar, salt. Every flavor has salt. And then whatever the flavor is. There's some variations on that here or there. But basically, that's our formula. And we have one egg flavored ice cream, but that's all it is. It's an American egg flavor, so it's like a custard. So for me, I find that the flavor of an egg yolk has a specific flavor, so I keep that to its own place, and then everything else we just try to keep the medium as clean as we can. So
neutral,
as neutral as possible. And then also a big part of our process was like making sure that the butter fat content was as low as possible, which is a little bit contradictory because traditionally in ice cream making, higher butterfat content always translated into better ice cream. But that was at a time when there were
mouthfeel,
but also like at that time you would have so many sort of bad versions of ice cream being made by big industrial organizations where they were substituting all different kinds of things instead of cream because cream's expensive. Whereas for me, we basically, if we have more milk and less cream, the frozen butterfat inhibits flavor release on your palate. So the lower the butterfat, the more that the ice cream is going to have the flavor. And then really balancing sweet with salt. And keeping our sugar content level really low, because sugar for me also does the same thing. It's a little bit tricky with ice cream because sugar helps to keep the ice cream soft, and we want those textures to be soft. So we serve our ice cream at a pretty warm temperature because our sugar content is relatively low. Not to get too technical with it.
No, but you do. I mean, I've been to the factory. I mean, you got a store and it's downstairs. It's the basement. And you really are small batch shit. I mean, you're doing those little things.
I can't produce the texture of the ice cream when we bump it up into larger scale size production. So it's just more about being organized. And we have a huge menu also, which is like really important to me. So
you have a fuck ton of flavors.
Yeah, we want to have a lot of flavors available and like more. You know, I said earlier I'm going to change the menu in March, and it's really challenging because we cap out there at around 40 flavors on the board. And then there's more flavors happening all the time because we're testing, or so we reach our capacity with just how much space we have and what's realistic. And so when we break the menu back down, then we have to like really carefully kind of dissect what we can pull off the menu and then what we can put on the menu. So I'm going through that process right now and figuring out. Ice cream parlor is interesting. You know, I come from working in restaurants where it's like good to change the menu a lot. And in an ice cream parlor, what you realize is people come.
They want that thing that they had it the last three times.
Right.
They fell in love with that flavor.
And they want to come back for that. And they also bring people and they're like, you got to try this Vietnamese coffee ice cream. So, and it's really a part of the business model. And if that's not there for them, then you might break that.
Base.
So it's, so we've waited. I haven't really done a major menu overhaul in almost 2 years. But I had to really, I felt like I needed to be comfortable to establish the base. And that's something that I think is actually really critical. So the concept there, as far as how Morgenstern's evolved, you know, I wanted to open Morgenstern's in 08, and I didn't have the, I didn't have what I needed together. I didn't have enough money, and I like couldn't get it done. And I knew that it was this thing that was going to be really personal for me. And I named it after myself, obviously. So I was like, I need to, you know, be able to do it right. And then that meant that I didn't want to have equity partners in the thing. So I'm by myself on Morgenstern's, and I don't have a trust fund, and I don't have some big like investment group behind me. And I, you know, worked as a cook. So I wasn't like a banker who switched into ice cream with like, I already have my $1 million house in the Hamptons and now let me go open an ice cream store. So I had to understand how to run the business, you know, so the General Green was an excellent opportunity for me to learn about that. Goat Town was the most informative experience for me in understanding how to run the business on the back end, you know, making sure that you're solvent at the end of every month, quarter, and year. And I was talking to Gerardo this morning, early this morning. We were talking about how a lot of times you can have a freshman success, you know, the first thing you do. And my experience is that the sophomore thing is where you like face plant, like you thought you knew. And I've seen it happen a lot of times. So it's happened to me. And then after that, if you still have it in you to keep going, to get back on the horse and keep going, then maybe, you know, a little bit of humility and also some experience, you know, together. And so, you know, El Rey happened after that, and then Morgenstern's was after that. El Rey and Morgenstern's leases were signed on the same day. You know, that was a good idea, bro. What the hell was I thinking? I rode my bicycle from one landlord to another landlord and handed him like
checks.
Crazy checks, bro. Yeah. Like when you sign a lease, it's like,
yeah, bend over.
Yo, to get a store in New York City, like a regular store in New York City in a good location in Manhattan, you're going to sign over 40, 50 G's just to get the keys. And then your budget starts ticking from there, whatever period they give you with no rent. You're just like, hammer, hammer, hammer. So, and then Morgenstern's was tough for me, too, because I design all the stores. And I saw, it's like, that's a thing. I love to get into that and figure out how they're going to function and everything like that. And Morgenstern's, I was like, so, it was difficult. I didn't have a lot of reference material to look at to say, what do I want it to look like? There's not a lot of other ice cream stores to really reference, at least for, in my mind, what I thought it should look like. So it took me a long time, and I was so obsessed with making sure that it was built like a battleship.
Yeah,
so,
I remember when you were building it. I bicycled down that block
all
the time.
Yeah, that's right. And so
we were going downstairs. You had these guys who were great.
I GC'd that job. I mean, I had trades in there, plumbers, electricians, and I have guys that I've done a lot of work with, so it was good because I could be like, this is how we do it.
That's kind of a classic, I don't want to say a timeless look, but I mean, you have people wearing those little white hats and the white shirts. And it kind of looks like an ice cream parlor of yore in a way.
I just thought that those were the things that made sense for what it should be for that. So that's what I did. And then it wasn't like we were trying to make it feel nostalgic necessarily, but that was where the cues were coming from culturally.
The glass
for me.
Counter, you approach the counter, the menu's up on the wall, there's the flavors, scoop by hand, take a number, we'll be back to you in a minute. I mean, it's just got a classic.
If you're designing something like that by yourself, though, you can't imagine how complicated it becomes to make all those decisions, everything. So it took me time to build the store.
And the production facilities downstairs. Which
Man,
is
that,
another...
You know what? Honestly, that's a easy for me because I've been in so many kitchens, like you map it out and you just figure it out. But in the front of the house, I was like really took a lot of time to figure it. Like that little bench with the school desks on it and right when you walk in was like, I've never seen that before, but it was a function of not having a lot of space. So that store took me a long time to open and then I really was blown away by how people responded to it. I never would have told you that I thought that was going to happen.
Who's the girl? Do you still have on that left side? It's like art by that Japanese girl or sort of looks.
Jess Jay. She's Chinese.
Chinese.
She's
from San Francisco.
Yeah, yeah.
But what is that? What's her deal? It's really cool shit.
Jess has worked with me for a long time, has done all of the collateral for all of the stores, and I'm very interested in illustration, and so that's something that has
been there,
percolating for me for a long time. So we talked about her doing original work and different kinds of things. And I mean, for me, I think she killed it.
It's funny. An old friend of mine is really close to Ralph Steadman.
Oh, so, wow.
Yeah, when Ralph was in last time, I got made a reservation at Mangeoire. I guess when the movie came out, Ralph, I wanted to go to some classic French, in an English accent. I wanted to go to some classic French. Mangeoire, go to Mangeoire. Delouvrier is a beast. He's not going to be there much longer. Yeah, Steadman's cool. So we have all those interests. Yeah, I remember. Anna had a party for Goat Town at her house before it opened.
Yeah.
Those bearded guys that did the sound system, those two twins.
Yep, with their brothers, yeah.
Brothers.
And they did, with the audio system. That's still at GG's, too.
Yeah.
We went crazy with that thing. We had a crazy amplifier system, so then we built a sound system. The audio system at GG's on Fifth Street is crazy. Yeah, there's a big sub, and there's 25 speakers in an 800-foot room, but balanced.
I'm mad at stereos. I spent a lot of money.
It's all Rain. All that stuff is all Rain. It's all Rain amps and Rain equalizers, and then all the audio is built in to the acoustics in the ceiling.
Attention to detail. I love it.
That was a big deal.
Well, thanks for fucking coming out to Bushwick. Thanks for bringing ice cream.
Awesome.
We are honored.
Cool. Great to be here.
Engineer Jill says thank you. I can see her. She's waving from the engineer salon saying thank you for the ice cream. No, kidding. All right, so take care. Be good. I will see you at your shop soon.
Awesome.
So Morgan Stearns is on Rivington?
Yeah, 2 Rivington, between Bower and Christie.
Right, so it's right around the corner from Pearl and Ash, Rebel, great location. That whole neighborhood's blown up.
Yep.
El Rey is on Stanton, between
Ludlow
Orchard
and Orchard.
Orchard and Ludlow, north side of the block.
Yep.
GG's 5th
between for A and B.
It's a great room. It's a cool room. Tiled ceiling, has a real groovy feel to it. A super approachable menu.
Awesome.
Really love what that chef's doing.
Cool.
And I have to get back, because you're right. I mean, you reminded me. These pizzas are badass.
Just killing it, man. Bobby's killing the pizza.
He's got those simple roasts that he does. Everything is kind of
But when I eat the pizza there now, I'm just like, oh, man. Because I eat a lot of pizza now. I get into it, and I really feel like what he's doing there is something. I mean, obviously, I'm biased, but I try to be objective when I eat the pizza. And I think that the pizza that Bobby is turning out there is like the Capo de Grade is clam pie. It's like, and I eat clam pizzas. I go out now and I eat clam pizzas, and like he just nailed that thing. It's amazing.
What's with the race car real fast?
I bought a 72 Datsun. I have a Datsun 620, which is a truck, and then I have a bunch of Datsuns, and so I just bought. I know it's dumb.
You're
so
in Manhattan. You're
solid rear.
Fucking car.
Don't worry, I got it under control. I got a solid rear axle wagon that's prepped for vintage racing of the era from when Datsun was winning crazy races back then. So I picked this thing up really basically to have all my friends who I do flavors with get their name on the car and then get it to the track for SCCA and run around town in this thing. So you're going to see it. Watch.
I can't wait. Watch. Nick Morgan Stearns, man. Google him. Find his places. It'll be some of the best ice cream you will ever have in your life. Trust me on that. See you next week. I don't know who my guests are, but they're booked. See you next week. Take care.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.